The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the Transmission of the Light, Case 28, Prajnatara. The Buddhist master Punyamitra said to Prajnatara, "Do you remember events of the past?" Prajnatara said, "I remember in a distant eon I was living in the same place as you. You were expounding the great wisdom and I was reciting the most profound scripture. This event today is in conformity with past cause." Kazan's verse. The light of the moon reflected in the depths of the pond is bright in the sky. The water flowing to the horizon is thoroughly clear and pure. Sifting and straining over and over, even if you know it exists, boundless and clear, it turns out to be utterly ineffable. I remember years ago somebody saying to me that the Zen tradition didn't emphasize karma, that there was only one koan that really dealt with karma, which was Bajang and the Fox. I begged to differ. So all along ago, I've been drawing upon, for the talks, koans and teachings that deal directly with karma. Not always in an explicit way. Here it's fairly explicit, but in ways that karma is there. Do you remember events of the past? If each of us tried to reflect back on the trail that has led us to here, the path that you have traveled to arrive here today, since the beginning of when you became aware, moments of shift, of collapse, of the arising of faith, desperation, receiving guidance, some good luck, making good choices, responding to difficult situations. But still, how could we know, really? We might be able to sift and strain and pull out significant moments, moments of that maybe nobody else was even aware of. I mean, think about conversations that someone had with you or people had with you in which something very significant either happened in that moment or later, and they never knew. Maybe we didn't even know in that moment. But like the planting of a seed that began to take root. And of all the possible directions, all the possible possibilities. You know, it's like siblings in a family, or like, why does one person head in one direction? Which sometimes is very different than the way everybody else is heading. So what I was talking about on Sunday is that the spiritual path, in a way, can be lonely, sort of in a different way, in a more ordinary sense than I was talking about on Sunday, particularly before we find others. Particularly for those of us who were practicing before Buddhism kind of existed, you know, in a more known way, in a more popular way. Before the internet, before the magazines, before all the Dharma centers, could feel like, I felt like I was doing something that felt very clear and true, but nobody else I knew was doing it. And I didn't feel like there was anybody I could talk to about it. And there were times where I wondered, like, what's up with me? Do You remember events of the past. Each action arises from a desire, and that leads to some response. Our intentions arise from desires, and Buddhism teaches in abundance how when those desires are based in grasping and clinging and the poisons and things that are basically not serving us well, but we are often serving those impulses. Versus when those desires or intentions arise out of a genuine place, a more affirming, true place, sometimes more true than we know at the moment. So many paths, particularly today, I mean, maybe there have always been an abundance, but now they're all posted all over the place. Teachings, practices. Rebecca Lee was here last week, a teacher in the Dharma Drum community, a student of Master Sheng Yan's, and she and I had a number of conversations. We've gotten to be friends with each other, and we were talking about about with the pandemic and teaching online and, you know, speaking into a camera, and you don't really know who's on the other side. And you don't know where they're at. You don't know where they are in terms of Buddha Dharma. You don't know if they're practicing, what they're practicing, where they are with their practice in a way. And of course, there are many people, many of you, on the other side of that camera that, for instance, I do know, I do have relationships with. But like with retreats and Sunday talks and so on, it's, you know, it's just going out there. And she was talking about, we were talking about the sort of precarious nature of that, because the Dharma can be so easily misunderstood, and is all the time, all the time. And sometimes in sort of normal ways, slight ways, ways that are normal for a practitioner to not quite fully understand the Dharma or understand it somewhat not correctly, but in a way that's normal. And that gets worked out because they're practicing, and hopefully they're practicing with others or with a teacher, so that that's going to get sort of aligned over time. But sometimes the misunderstandings can be quite significant. And we were just reflecting on how throughout the centuries of Buddhism, up to, well, I mean, think about in the Buddhist time where there was nothing written. So if you wanted to hear a teaching, you actually had to be in the physical presence of somebody who was teaching, which meant you saw them and they saw you. And then even with the written word and texts and sutras and teachings being written down, still the traditional sort of predominant way that a teaching was received was in the physical presence of. And that's there's a reason for that. There's a kind of safeguard that the teacher knows who is in front of them, knows what to say in a sense and what not to say. What aspects of a teaching or the Dharma to bring out and what to not bring out. Anyway, that wasn't really what I was planning on talking about. I mean, one of the, since I'm on it, one of the things about that is that she was saying that, you know, and so in a way, to be safe, sometimes the teachings have to be made more elementary, which is my experience of many of the teachings that I see online, is that they're really, in a way, made safer in that way. So how do we know if the path is true? How do we know if it's true for us? And so to have an affinity, in other words, there's something that you feel. There's something that you sense when you come into contact with a teacher or a teaching or a tradition or a practice that we may or may not fully understand, but there's something about it that feels trustworthy, that feels in alignment, that feels like calling us in. In the teachings, it said that when we encounter the Dharma, we should, there are four reliances. One, we should rely on the teaching and not the teacher. In other words, when we're, in a sense, what we're ultimately taking refuge in is the Dharma. And so when we encounter a teaching, it's the teaching that we're really taking refuge in, that we're really trying to encounter, not the teacher. The teacher is really a vehicle. That's their purpose. And that we rely on the meaning of that teaching, not the words, not just what the words say, which means we have to enter in a little bit deeper and reflect on what is this teaching? What do these words mean? What is being conveyed? And not come to hasty conclusions about that. That in terms of skillfulness within teachings and training, that we need to rely on the ultimate purpose of that rather than the action itself. I think of Dada Roshi's formulation of the eight gates, and particularly to bring our attention to not just as a structure, but to actually bring our conscious attention to these areas, traditional areas of training that we're engaging, but so that we actually examine them, like they're sort of held up as a specific practice, like liturgy, or the precepts, or work practice, and so on. So that we're not just following the action, doing the thing, following along with everybody else, but we're actually trying to engage this and say, what is this? Why is this? Why is this important on this path? And of course, the catch of that is to really know for ourselves, we have to trust enough to enter into it. Because if we just stand on the outside and try and understand why before we engage, then it's just going to be intellectual. And if there's resistance or, you know, history, then we might not even take that step. And so it always asks that we have to actually put something in before, in a sense, that Dharma is going to give something back. And that we need to rely on our non-conceptual wisdom rather than intellectual understanding. We cultivate intellectual, conceptual understanding, but we shouldn't rely on that. The purpose of that is to bring us into a direct understanding. And so, because our attachments are strong and our habits are old and our projections are so prolific and seemingly automatic, because the way we impute meaning into things is so reactive and so complex, we really need powerful teachings and powerful practices. But those don't have power until they have power within us. They don't exist in a void. And so the only way they really gain power is within us. And again, it's a mutual kind of thing. That we give, in a sense, our faith, our commitment, our dedication, our effort to it. And in that way, that Dharma, that teaching, that practice opens its door and says, hello, I've been waiting for you. It's like doing Zazen and doing Sesshin and seeing our minds buffeted around by things we brought in with us, things going on in our life, things going on in the world, just random blather. And that because of the force of that, the strength of that, we have to meet it. That's why we can't be that's why practice can't be passive. We have to meet it with some energy, which is commitment, which is trust, which is skill. And of course, that in the beginning is not that strong. And so we get tossed around quite a bit. But as time goes on, that gets stronger and stronger. And all of those habitual forces begin to get weaker and weaker. Do you remember events of the past? Too often these memories constrain and bind us. we keep something alive in our mind long past when it was actually alive, that is no longer serving us well. And so from the beginning, the Buddha realized we have to have very skillful ways of working with that karma, because we can't just jump past it. And so how do we meet all of those tethers, those fetters within us that we associate with our past but are really alive here and now? How do we free ourselves? So sometimes the path of letting go is very simple, happens in a moment, and sometimes it's a long path, letting go of something that is strong and deep. And in a certain way, sometimes we may practice that for certain things in our lives our whole life. And yet throughout, it's our experience of it, the way it is arising, the effect it's having on us is going through, can go through a profound transformation. Prajnatara, as many of you know, is thought to have been a woman teacher, female teacher, and among some circles. I don't know if that's been sort of generally accepted, but some years ago I heard about this and I sent a couple of letters or emails out to some scholars that we are that are friends of the Sangha and asked them about this. And one or two of them sort of discounted it out of hand. Another one or two said that they'd heard that and it was quite possible given a number of different factors. And so in this accounting, there's a student of G.U. Kennett's who is no longer alive, but who traced this down. Her teacher in Japan said that in their lineage, there were a number of female teachers, but they weren't necessarily identified because the names are not gender specific. And so one of G.U. Kennett's, Roshi's students began to research this. And so Prajnatara is understood or thought to be a female, believed to be a female teacher in the Korean tradition of Song Buddhism, the Korean tradition of Chan or Zen. Also, it's said that there are certain historical or oral traditions in the area of India where Prajnatara is said to have lived, which hold that tradition that she was a woman. And so that's given credibility because those stories tend to get passed down and have credence. And third, because there supposedly are archaeological discoveries that have confirmed this. I don't know what those are, and I wasn't able to find them. Prajnatara, her name, Prajnaparamita, and Tara, the great bodhisattva of compassion. So that also gives cause to believe that she was a woman. Her story, such as we have it, is that she was homeless. She was born as an orphan and was homeless. She called herself Keyura. I may be mispronouncing that, which means bracelet or necklace. And she basically lived by begging. And one day she encountered Punyamitra, who she immediately had an affinity with, and she became his disciple and eventually his successor. And when she renounced the world and was ordained, she took the name Prajnatara. And she went on to become widely known as a really profound teacher. When there was some trouble in the northern part of India, invasions and such, and she went down south to where her teacher, Punyamitra, had lived or was living, and she befriended the king there who had a young son, Bodhitara. And she noticed this young fellow because of his spiritual abilities. And so when the king died, she took him as a disciple and eventually named him Bodhidharma. And so he became her disciple. She transmitted to him and so on. And then she advised him to go to China after her death and spread the Dharma there. And then Bodhidharma had a female teacher, Dzongchur, who we chant every day, who was well recorded in the records as having been one of Bodhidharma's successors and a woman. So in this commentary, Keizan says, even if you seem to be a beginner, if in a single moment the mind is turned around to reveal its original inherent qualities, nothing is lacking at all. Together with the realized ones, you will commune with the Buddhas. That even as a beginner, in one moment when the mind turns in accord with the Dharma, even before we realize it, we are attuned to that reality, that there's nothing lacking, and that we are in communion with the Buddhas, standing on the same ground, breathing the same breath. Because we perceive so much as lacking, it takes a great effort to reverse the tide, to shift the axis. And so we engage all of these, this body of wisdom, these teachings, these practices, to shift the flow of the river, to change the tide of the ocean. We raise bodhicitta again and again. We bring to mind, in the sense of mindfulness, which in part means to remember, we bring to mind again and again what must be remembered. We come close. We strengthen that sense of affinity. What are the four reminders when we reflect on this precious human life? It requires that we think about this life of mine, this life of yours, how I'm using it. When I reflect on impermanence and death, then it puts this life into a stark sort of sense of reality. It is precious and it's fleeting. When we reflect on samsara, on all the events of the past, on our karma, on the karma of humanity, on the state of things today, and the various promises that are made in so many different ways, and how, in a sense, they're all betrayals, they're all false or incomplete truths. And those very honest reflections, very honest turning towards this life, the very things that we're encouraged really to avoid at all costs, to not think about, to not contemplate. And indeed, they can be hard to contemplate without skills, without a way, because we can just drown, not in those realities so much, but in what our mind does with them. Because without a path, what is one to do? Look around and see what your best options are. Try and find some good examples. In short, I think it brings us to the imperative of Zazen, of sitting. Something so simple and so endlessly profound. Sitting within this very body and mind that so often has seemed to be the cause or the source of our struggle, and turning towards it in a way that is most skillful, because it is most in tune with the body and mind. In a way, practice and the teachings are like our own wisdom speaking and saying, "Hey, is anybody listening? Try this. Stop. Stop." Dogen speaks of it as the lancet of self-inquiry. And of course, the surprise is, you know, it's like, how many times do I hear of students telling friends or colleagues they're going off to do Seishin, and they say, oh, you're going to have such a wonderful, calm, relaxing, quiet, tranquil, peaceful. I'm saying, yeah, aren't you? Somewhere in there? But the surprise is, to all of us, is when we sit down, we find all of that stuff we thought we were going to get away from. The heavens and hells, the enlightenment and delusion, our kindness and our mean-heartedness. As Huainong said, we see all the many beings in our mind, and they are abundant. And we're trying to meet each of them in wisdom, meet each of them in peace. No more fighting. The example of that, we need no more. The karma of that is clear beyond, well, it would seem to be clear beyond debate, but debate continues. We meet all of the me, all of the you, because that is the only way. And we learn to meet that without bias. We learn to meet that just. Shikantaza means just sit. In essence, that's every form of zazen, is just sit. Just breath, just koan, just awareness, just mantra, just visualization, just emotion, just sensation. And it's right there that we have to apply effort. Because just very quickly, before we know it, has become populated with so much more. And so in the same way the scholars say that Prajnatara was assumed to be male because the inference, the assumption was that all the teachers were men. Because the names don't communicate. And how dependent that is, that those assumptions, those inferences on events of the past appearing in the present, associations, culture, desires, who has access to power, who's telling the story, who's writing the history, that then becomes what is true. And then we see how that is just a larger manifestation of what our mind does all the time. It meets those many beings within our mind with all of that bias. And so that basic instruction of when something arises, to meet it without judgment, it's like that really can't be emphasized enough. And yet, no matter how much it's emphasized, it's almost like we need to, well, if we tattooed it on our forehead, we wouldn't see it. If everybody had it tattooed on their forehead, that might be hard to pull off. Da Wei said, keep the question of life and death at the tip of your nose. In other words, how do we remember? But it's not just remembering, it's trusting. It's believing. Believing that I should not, that we should not, in the moment when it seems so patently clear that we should. When judgment, and this particular judgment of this particular arising, is so called for, is so valid, that's what's so hard. And that is both the result of a whole system set into motion. We call it the samskaras, we call it dependent origination, we call it the skandhas, we call it dukkha. And it in turn creates a whole new system in this moment, again, anew. And that's why we have to practice with effort. That's why sustained practice, such as we do during Sesshin, is so important. Because there's something that happens. There's something that happens when we do a daily practice that is essential and that opens certain windows. And there's something that happens when we do sustained practice, such as we are this week, that opens those and other windows. And when that happens, when we go back to our daily practice, more windows are open. And that becomes its own kind of system, if you will, its own kind of cycle, but a positive cycle, and a cycle that we are aware of. It's not a habit, in the sense, even though practice may become a habit in the sense that we do it, you know, steadily. But it's not a habit in the old way because of our mindfulness, because we are aware and we are actively engaging in this and we understand it enough. I was thinking of, in this, in terms of events of the past, and this event today is in conformity with past cause. And we can understand that in terms of how we ordinarily think of karma, in terms of cause leading to result, but we can think of it in a, also in a more profound way. This event today is completely attuned, is not apart from, is not separate from the causes of the past. And I was thinking of the section in the Lotus Sutra on the Bodhisattva never disparaging. And so the Buddha said that there was a time before his time when students of overbearing arrogance exercised great authority and power. So that, in other words, students had become very arrogant. They had lost their way. And at that time, there was a Bodhisattva named Never Disparaging. And whenever this student would meet other people, whoever they were, monastics, lay students, they would bow to them and say, "I have profound reverence for you. I would never dare treat you with disparagement or arrogance." Why? Because you're all practicing the Bodhisattva path and are certain to attain Buddhahood. Now he's speaking to students of overbearing arrogance, right? Who have lost their way. But that's okay. Because this is Bodhisattva never disparaging. And so whoever they met, they always said, "I have profound reverence for you. Because you are all practicing the Bodhisattva path, even when poorly, ultimately will attain Buddhahood." And it says that this Bodhisattva didn't devote their time to reading or reciting the scriptures, but simply went around bowing to people. That's all they did. That was their practice. And wherever they saw somebody, even if they were off in a distance, they would rush over there so that they could bow down to them and say, "I would never disparage you. I have complete respect and reverence for you." Now, among all those that the Bodhisattva bowed to, there were those who, the sutra says, gave way to anger, their minds lacking in purity. They spoke ill of this Bodhisattva and cursed him, saying, "This stupid student, this stupid Bodhisattva, where are they coming from? Presuming to declare that they don't disparage us and bestow on us a prediction that we will attain Buddhahood. We have no use for such vain and irresponsible predictions." You know, it's interesting how often in the sutra, in the teachings, going back hundreds and hundreds of years, there's talk about if you are slandered as a practitioner, as a person of the way, as a person on the path, if people, like, you know, don't bow down to you, but throw rocks and stones at you. In other words, don't respect you. I've often wondered about that, you know. You know, think about it, just when we meet truth, when we meet someone who is embodying, is providing an example of something that is true, and particularly with such generosity. And if we, on the other hand, are sort of back in a tight, miserly little corner and don't know it, how how we don't like it. We don't like seeing that. It's showing us something. How difficult it is to meet what is true. How difficult it is to meet that within ourselves. And so we develop patience and forbearance. Remember, forbearance is an aspect of patience, paramita, which means sometimes we have to practice patience, we actually just have to forbear something that is difficult. And it is difficult. And it continues to be difficult. So there is that element that sometimes that's our practice. That's what we need to do. And that doesn't mean that we just are passive, that if there's something we can do to ameliorate, we do that. But that practicing our utmost, being in attune, in accord with the Dharma, doesn't mean it's always going to be tranquil and serene. And so it's said that many years passed, and during which this bodhisattva was receiving all of these curses and abuse, but never gave way to anger, and would always say, I bow down to you, I have reverence for you, you someday will attain Buddhahood. And that when this bodhisattva was on the point of death, there was a miraculous display in the sky, and all of these disparaging students realized that this was a very profound being. And at that point, all of those who had looked with contempt on this bodhisattva now saw that they, in fact, were a very transcendental being with the power to preach and teach the Dharma. And so they all became students of Never Disparaging on the path to their enlightenment. So how do these stories from the past speak to us today? How have they spoken to students of every generation? Right? Because of our mind and our mind's ability to create and connect and associate, we can take this story, which is presented as something that happened in this sutra, and we can believe in it literally if we choose, but beyond that, we can also, with our mind, bring it into this moment, this time. And of course, this is an ordinary thing that we do all the time. Not always skillfully. Where do we find our inspiration? I think that maybe as we practice more and more, and our heart opens, and we see into these things a little bit more, it's easier and easier to find inspiration. Kazan says, therefore, seeing today is seeing all of time. Looking over the ages is guarding the present. The enlightened ones are born together with you and live together with me without the slightest separation, accompanying us at all times. When you manage to arrive at this state, it is not something of the past, future, or present. It is not a matter of senses or objects or consciousness. This is why it's said that succession to the reality of Buddha Dharma transcends time, that realization continuously pervades time. Because it is so, the golden needle and jade thread pass through finally. When you look closely, which is other? Which is yourself? Neither the frame nor the point shows. Here, everyone gets a seat, and it is always shared.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.